It's Wednesday, July 7th, and America's longest war is ending as we speak. We start here. The Pentagon announces that well ahead of schedule, 90% of American forces have already exited Afghanistan.
What's happening right now and how alarmed are you?
We should be concerned.
Our Martha Raddatz has returned from what used to be America's most closely guarded turf. The last plan to get to herd immunity wasn't quite a success. Well, President Biden's got a new plan.
This is the ground game. It's going to be hard work. It's being get out into the community.
Health experts say the coronavirus itself is actually more dangerous than ever. We'll walk through the risks. And 6 months after January 6th, police are responding to more self-declared militias.
They were seen with long guns, with pistols.
What happens when men with guns show up in your town and say, the rules don't apply to us? From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey.
On my orders, the United States military has begun strikes against Al-Qaeda terrorist training camps and military installations of the Taliban regime in Afghanistan.
There was a time when it seemed utterly plausible that the U.S. could invade Afghanistan, wipe out small, cluttered cells of terrorists, and leave. That was the impression a lot of Americans had, at least, when we went to war.
In the face of today's new threat, the only way to pursue peace is to pursue those who threaten it. We did not ask for this mission, but we will fulfill it.
We already have service members doing their duty in Afghanistan today whose parents served in the same war.
Well, the last time that scenario really seemed plausible was 19 years ago. Since then, more than 2,000 U.S. troops have been killed. Tens of thousands of civilians have been killed.
We'll not conduct a hasty rush to the exit. We'll do it responsibly, deliberately, and safely.
Well, the moment is coming where the U.S. will no longer have forces there. This is becoming a reality. And if you've been alive for these last 19 years, it's coming more quickly and suddenly than you might have ever thought possible. In fact, as of this morning, the Department of Defense says more than 90% of our troops are gone. It could be 100% very, very soon. ABC's Chief Global Affairs Correspondent Martha Raddatz is here. Martha, I mean, where does the withdrawal stand as we start the day?
Brad, I think we hear the Defense Department say more than 90%, but from what I saw in Afghanistan, it is really largely empty of American and coalition forces.
Okay, General, just give us a situation here now today in Bagram and what's going on.
And what you're seeing here today is you're seeing the equipment that will return to the United States or other home countries.
At Bagram Airfield, this is 14 square miles of airfield. There were 38,000 Americans there at one point. This is where all of the assaults were launched from. This is where our wounded Americans were brought back to.
What does it feel like to say goodbye to Bagram?
It's a little bittersweet because, you know, you have the mission here. You've had a connection to this country for...
This is where the body of Osama bin Laden was brought for official recognition.
So it's a little surreal to see things very bare and empty.
We flew low over that airfield, and to see that after watching this war for nearly 20 years was really astounding. It is really empty. There were reportedly some looters who came in as soon as the Americans left, and now the Afghan forces are there.
You joined the Army 1 month before 9/11.
This is your history, right here. It is great. I mean, this is part of history, and I'm pretty sure that what we're doing here is going to go in the books.
And in Kabul, I walked around the military headquarters. I think there have been 9 commanders. I think I've probably interviewed most of them. And it really was a ghost town. The shops and the vendors, they're all gone. The little coffee shops, the headquarters is all but abandoned. So we are really almost out of there.
Well, and so what is the withdrawal of troops? I mean, what does that look like in real time if you're there? Because, we've heard reports that this Bagram thing was like a fly-by-night operation. One day we're there, the next day we're gone. I mean, how does that work logistically?
It really has happened very rapidly. As soon as President Biden gave the order, they started what's called a retrograde. They had almost 1,000 cargo planes, these C-17s, these massive cargo planes, taking the equipment out.
A clear objective is, you know, not only a safe but an orderly withdrawal. And we talk
now.
Safe,
the commanding general, General Scott Miller, Austin Scott Miller, is still there, and he will remain there for a while.
And how we do that is one, we position our fires in places that they're able to overwatch and prevent any attacks on the, you know, on our forces. And if there are attacks, we certainly have the ability to respond to those.
The other thing we have to remember is there are going to be about 650 U.S. military that remain, but their principal job is protecting the U.S. embassy.
That's what I was trying to get a sense of, Martha. It's like what counts as an American presence there? You're saying 650 troops is not the same as a war presence.
No, it's these are not combat troops. I would almost say these are just emergency troops to get U.S. personnel out of that embassy. It's a big embassy. To get U.S. embassy personnel out of there if they have to and to protect them. I mean, think about it. That's a pretty dangerous place to be if you don't have U.S. forces there, if you don't have the intelligence that we've had there for years and years and years, intelligence that's not perfect even when they're there. With them gone, it's going to be much, much harder to gather intelligence.
Well, and so let's talk about the idea of, like, who fills the vacuum, right? Because, I mean, you already mentioned there was looting on the airfield because, like, no one's there. When we talk about the Taliban taking over parts of the country that used to be controlled by coalition forces, how fast could that realistically happen? Is it months? Is it days? What is it?
It's right now, there are a variety of estimates how much terrain the Taliban has taken over, but it is as much as one third of the country, and they are still on the move.
Since America's deal with the Taliban, the violence has escalated in a growing climate of fear and chaos. The Taliban are advancing.
We have seen these videos, these Taliban released videos. There was one that I obtained when I was in Afghanistan showing them what appears to be the massacre of Afghan forces. They all had their hands up, and yet the Taliban gunned them all down.
In the alarming new images tonight, the video reportedly showing Afghan troops handing over weapons to the Taliban.
Other reports of Afghan forces fleeing across the northern border.
Devastating bomb blast near a school in Afghanistan, killing at least 30, wounding more than 50. One eyewitness saying there were a lot of casualties, most of them girls, and bodies were everywhere.
You know, most of the violence hasn't been in Kabul, but there has been an uptick in violence in Kabul. And the great fear is that the Taliban will move into Kabul. That's the real fear. What's happening right now, and how alarmed are you?
We should be concerned. The loss of terrain and the rapidity of that loss of terrain has to be concerning.
I was on what was supposed to be the last convoy out of Iraq in 2011. What was supposed to be did not turn out to be, because ISIS moved in years later and swept through that country.
Would you have liked to have seen a small force stay here?
Let me hold on that one.
And I think that is on everyone's mind. It's certainly on General Miller's mind.
Hey, last question for you. You know, we heard 90% from the military. You say it's actually more than 90%. Is there a day when the Pentagon is going to come out and say soon, we're out? Like, our last people are gone. Is there a day on the calendar for that?
I think that will happen after they are out. And that's for the protection of the force. You don't want to say, okay, we're all leaving tomorrow. Mm-hmm. But there will not be very many people there, very many military personnel up until that point when they make it official after they have left.
Yeah, first we were told September, then August. We'll see how quickly this could happen because, like you said, it sounds like it's just unfolding so, so rapidly. Martha Raddatz, just back from Afghanistan. Thanks so much.
Great to talk to you, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, they say there are three sides to every story, except the spread of the Delta variant. We're back in a bit.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
And the bottom line is the virus is on the run and America is coming back. We're coming back together.
After some ice cream, some fireworks, and some fist bumping about how America's so-called independence from COVID-19, yesterday President Biden was back at work talking about how to keep more Americans from dying.
In today's briefing, we discussed how the Delta variant is already responsible for half of all cases in many parts of this country.
Because remember, the White House did not meet its own self-imposed goal for vaccinations in this country. Still hasn't.
This Springfield, Missouri hospital forced to bring in extra ventilators from other hospitals.
Now we're seeing numbers higher than we did in the original surge that we saw last year.
And that is a growing problem for a lot of emergency rooms around the nation. Because the virus that was killing so many people last year, well, that version of COVID-19 wasn't even as dangerous as the one circulating right now. Let's check in with Dr. Ashish Jha, the Dean of Brown University's School of Public Health. Dr. Jha, I mean, can you just put in perspective, how dangerous has this Delta variant become?
Yeah, it's a great question. And the short answer is it's pretty dangerous. It's the by far the most contagious version of the virus we have seen. It's probably more deadly as well. And so overall, this is not the time in the pandemic when you want to be unvaccinated. This is a pretty virulent version of this virus circulating around.
Well, and you recently said, you know, the choice eventually is just going to be vaccinate yourself or vaccinate your kid if it's allowed, or that person will get COVID. Like, that's just not up for debate anymore. Why is that?
Yeah, well, the virus is not going to go away, right? It doesn't, like, we've almost never have eradicated. There are a couple of viruses we have eradicated throughout human history, but that's rare. So then the virus will be around. It'll be circulating in low numbers, and everybody will end up encountering the virus. And you have two choices. You can be vaccinated and therefore not get infected or sick, or you can be unvaccinated and then you'll get infected, and then you'll get sick, and then you'll recover, hopefully. Most people will. And so everybody will end up getting immunity to this virus, and you have one of two choices. Do you want it the vaccine way, or do you want to do it the old-fashioned way and get sick?
The antibody way.
And that is not a great way to do it.
Well, then let's talk about the vaccines then and the efficacy of these vaccines, because this one study from Israel had actually become quite buzzy over the last few days, where it seemed to show Pfizer's vaccine goes from 90% effective against normal COVID. That's the one, that's the numbers we'd all been really excited about, to 64% effective against Delta. Can that be right?
Yeah, I have to say I'm pretty skeptical of that number. And let me say why. I mean, Israel's first of all been doing a great job of tracking this stuff. And even against Delta, it has been kind of 80, 90%. And then all of a sudden this week, the data seemed to drop to 64. And I'm like, I don't know what just happened in this past week. I don't think the vaccines became less effective. Look, I've got data from Canada that says it's 87%, data from the UK that says it's 88% against Delta. And therefore, I look at this as an anomaly. Again, I don't want to blow it off completely. Let's look at what all the data that comes in. But at this point, I remain pretty darn confident that Pfizer, Moderna, both of them are going to hold up really, really well against Delta.
Well, so if the key then to vaccinate, you know, these big parts of the country where people are not vaccinated, let's like when we talk about general population, barely more than half are fully vaccinated against COVID. What tools does President Biden have in his toolkit that he hasn't already tried? He said yesterday he's going to make a big push to get more people vaccinated. How do you actually do that at this point?
Yeah, first of all, there's no silver bullet, right? It's sort of an all of the above. So if you think about it, about half of Americans are fully vaccinated. Another way of saying about half are not. So what is it going to take to help people who are not vaccinated get the shot?
Across the country, workers going door to door, encouraging Americans to get the shot.
We are just getting information out about the vaccine.
For some people, it's going to take better information. There's a huge misinformation campaign targeting people to try to dissuade them from vaccines, and you got to counter it with higher quality information.
We're going to step up efforts to get vaccines to your family doctors and other doctors who serve younger people so that adolescents ages 12 to 18 can get vaccinated And as they go for back to school checkups,
other people, you know, they're kind of on the fence. They're willing to do it, but they don't really want to take the time out, or it's a bit inconvenient. They don't know when. For those people, it's going to take making it super duper convenient, getting it into the doctor's offices, making sure every pharmacy in America has it.
But it's been convenient for a while now, right? Like, there's no line. There's no line at wherever you want to go.
Yeah, so it's not even like, you know, there's no line. So if you wake up one morning and say, I want to get vaccinated, you can go do it. But there are other people who, maybe they're at their doctor's office and the doctor says, hey, have you gotten the shot? And they say, no, I haven't. And the doctor says, hey, I can do it today, right now. Hmm. I can give you a shot. And coming from your trusted physician, that may make the difference.
The red states probably have a lot of people that, you know, are very, very conservative in their thinking. And they think, well, I don't have to do that. But they're not thinking right. When it really boils right down to it, they're in a lottery to themselves. You know, we have a lottery, you know, that basically says, if you're vaccinated, we're going to give you stuff. Well, you've got another lottery going on, and it's the death lottery.
This is the ground game. It's going to be hard work. It's being get out into the community, send vaccines to people's homes and get them vaccinated. The big thing I think that's going to make a huge difference is when companies, colleges start requiring people to be vaccinated to get back to work. Hmm. Because the truth is, it's going to be hard to run an office with everybody back in if half the people are not vaccinated. You're going to see big outbreaks.
Which is why you've been saying, let's have the FDA fully authorize these things so that you can't even say, oh, this is experimental. We're worried about it being experimental.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really critical the FDA do this. And look, I'm not asking the FDA to cut any corners at all. If I think about all the things that FDA approves and how much data they have, you got way more data for these vaccines. And these vaccines are turning out to be incredibly safe and effective. The FDA should just do this. Usually it just take longer, but right now, we're in the middle of a global pandemic. They've got the data. The data is very clear. The FDA should go ahead and move forward.
All right. Dr. Ashish Jha at Brown, thank you so much.
Hey, Brad, thanks for having me back.
We're gathered together in the heart of our nation's capital for one very, very basic and simple reason: to save our democracy.
Yesterday marked 6 months since a sort of sinking feeling devolved into a full-blown panic.
Trump!
When supporters of President Trump started moving toward the Capitol on the afternoon of January 6th, well, among some otherwise peaceful protesters, there were large cadres of people who had come to town on a mission, a violent one.
Trump supporters spraying police with chemicals and beating them with bats and metal pipes.
And so this week, lawmakers and investigators are still looking back at that day, trying to figure out, really, what happened. In some cases, they're still trying to figure out who was even there causing the damage.
I can see what I believe are probably the Oath Keepers and Proud Boys within the crowd and forming groups. They do have communications.
But others are pointing out that efforts by some groups to ignore or even to try to violently overthrow law enforcement, those efforts did not end on January 6th. In fact, some quickly posited this is a sign of more things to come. Let's go to ABC senior investigative reporter Aaron Katursky. Aaron, what are law enforcement telling you about how they see the risks going forward here?
They've seen January 6th, Brad, as a triggering event. And now the number one concern among counterterrorism officials at the Department of Homeland Security are these domestic violent extremists.
The FBI is also currently investigating a mix of suspected radicals it believes were present at the insurrection, who may be planning more violence. Supporters of QAnon, white supremacists, the Boogaloo.
We most recently saw a warning about this just ahead of the July 4th holiday weekend. We had a look at a bulletin that talked about violent extremists and the possibility of domestic terror and violence. And then, literally 3 days after that bulletin, came a traffic stop along Interstate 95 just north of Boston in Wakefield, Massachusetts.
This situation's been going on since 2 o'clock this morning. The highway shut down in both directions. It began with a traffic stop.
And Massachusetts State Police and local authorities were engaged in a long and intense standoff, it turned out, with a group called Rise of the Moors, who had stopped along the highway to refuel and had taken off into the woods.
One of the members live-streamed this video on the group's YouTube channel.
We're not anti-government. We're not anti-police, we're not sovereign citizens.
They weren't actually terrorizing anybody, but what they looked like and what they carried certainly seemed terrifying to law enforcement.
11 armed individuals standing with long guns slung on an interstate highway.
Because to hear the state police describe them, these guys, and there were 10 men and a 17-year-old juvenile who were ultimately arrested, but they were seen with long guns, with pistols, and it was the way they were dressed that was particularly unnerving in addition to the weapons.
Clad in what I would describe as tactical or military-style uniforms, BDUs, tactical vests, body-worn cameras.
And the state police colonel in Massachusetts had said they were on their way from Rhode Island to Maine for training. And he didn't specify what that training would be or whether they truly represented a violent threat, but certainly the way they were dressed and what they were carrying made police very, very nervous.
They did not have gun licenses on them, first of all. Massachusetts does not allow the carrying of a loaded or unloaded firearm on an interstate highway such as this.
And Brad, authorities still aren't quite sure what these men really represent. They were charged with gun offenses, and in rather bizarre arraignments, they appeared before a judge arguing that they had no business being in state court.
You understand that you are charged with a number of crimes. Do you understand that?
No, I do not.
All right.
That they were foreign nationals who needed to be charged in federal court.
We have our own counsel to delegate these matters in federal court.
And all the judge did was ask whether they wanted an attorney. And ultimately, she ended up holding them so she could figure out, you know, how to process all of these people going forward.
Well, and so that's what I'm trying to figure out, Aaron. Is this one of those things where groups like this, you know, less than a dozen people, but heavily armed, saying laws don't apply to us, have these groups always been around and perhaps we notice them more? Or have things really changed and escalated just over the last 6 months?
I think it's a little bit of both. We're attuned to these groups, Brad, because of what we saw January 6th. But these groups have been around. The Rise of the Moors, as this group in Massachusetts called itself, is a little bit different in terms of its makeup. But anti-government extremist groups generally, some of them driven by a white supremacist ideology, have been around for a long time.
By 1925, the Ku Klux Klan was big business. Almost 6 million Americans now belong to the Klan.
For a while in our history, their premise was at least tacitly supported by the American government. Then there was a shift in societal attitudes, and the groups tended to fade into more rural corners of the country.
What happened and why at the Branch Davidian compound outside Waco, Texas?
Our agents practiced for days on this, and they had bigger guns than we did.
The internet then brought them back into community, and people like former President Trump almost seemed to embrace them.
And by the way, who shot Ashley Babbitt? Who shot Ashley Babbitt?
And you think, Brad, okay, every country has their, you know, far right or far left extremist ideologies. Every country has problems with anti-government beliefs. The difference in America is our affinity for and our access to guns.
And there was news tonight of an alleged shooting plot foiled from a 12th floor Chicago hotel room. Police allegedly finding weapons and ammunition in that room on the 4th of July.
So oftentimes these groups are heavily armed, and law enforcement is concerned that they pose a threat for violence.
Yeah, in the meantime, in Washington, you see people moving on these two tracks. On one track, on the law enforcement track, they're still making arrests. More just happened this week. On the other hand, they are taking down the fencing outside the Capitol, saying that we don't want our lawmakers, our elected leaders, inside a fortress. Aaron Kutursky, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brad.
When we come back, we're going to uncork some controversy cage match style. One Last Thing is next.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
And one last thing. If you've ever talked to a wine snob anywhere, you know that sparkling wine can come from anywhere. Champagne can only come from one region. That's right, the ripe rolling hills of Russia. Wait, were you under the impression it was someplace else? Well, Vladimir Putin isn't. He recently signed a law that says any wine being imported into Russia cannot describe itself with the Russian word for champagne. That includes French sparkling wines from, you guessed it, the Champagne region, which now can keep the French word on the front of their label, but on the back in the official description must not dare call themselves Champanskaya. There's only one Champanskaya, and it's Russian. French winemakers are outraged. Some of the big brands halted exports to Russia entirely, but they're also just confused. They're thinking it's not like Champanskaya was a word before we gave you the word champagne. Some observers say Russia's been trying to revive its own wine industry, and this move fits right in line with Putin's bubbly personality. Absolutely brutal. And any other European country could not get away with this, because the EU has rules for naming rights on stuff like Greek feta cheese, Italian Parmesan. Russia, though, not in the EU. All right, you can get out of here, enjoy your day, maybe, hey, have a mimosa if the thoughts crossed your mind. More on all these stories at abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.